Rome was undoubtedly the very first world's superpower. I'm Dr. Fred. You're listening to another episode of Study, Grow, Know.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRuvo.
In his book, titled Roman Empire, Nigel Rogers was the first, probably, or one of the first, to refer to Rome as the first superpower in the history of the world. And certainly, I think that that's a true statement. He says this, the Roman Empire was the resolution of 700 years of struggle between various social classes and competing political systems. Roman history recounts the gradual triumph of democracy and popular government over an exclusive governing caste. Now, actually, that was taken from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, Volume 4, Q through Z, 1988, page 208. Now, as one might expect, the process was long and arduous. Rome wasn't built in a day. We've heard that statement. But eventually, mighty Rome, which began as a city on seven hills, transformed itself into the greatest empire that has yet existed. In fact, its eventual size is one of the reasons for Rome's eventual fall. It got so big, it could not contain itself. Now, as can be seen from many maps of the Roman Empire included pretty much all of the geographic land that previous empires were made of and then added to it. You can go to any map of Rome at its zenith, and you'll see this. It took over more of northern Africa from previous empires and had a far greater reach into Europe, and that included Great Britain as well. Now, the empire also pushed further east as well as south. So we've talked about this before. Rome had become larger than any of the previous empires and felt strong and confident because of it. Now, of course, like the empires that existed previously, Rome rose or fell at God's command, not Caesar's. Eventually, as we know, after Rome had reached its zenith, the decline began. And this was due not necessarily to the killing of Jesus, but because of Rome's part in its attack on the holy city of Jerusalem in AD 70. That was the beginning of the end. And that's something to really consider. And of course, that's in a biblical sense. However, prior to this major event, AD 70, which turned catastrophic for the Roman Empire, Rome first allowed the persecution of Christians, and this did not happen immediately either during the physical life of Jesus or immediately upon his death, including his resurrection and ascension. The persecution of Christians, it actually began over a period of time. Tiberius had reigned during the time of Christ, but he died in AD 37, a few years after Jesus was crucified, buried, and rose again. And this was ultimately too early to form any real opinion about Christianity, since in many ways it was still considered to be part of Judaism. This was still the case when the next emperor, Gaius, controlled things. He took the reins from AD 37 to AD 41. And during Gaius's reign, he inadvertently took the attention off of Christians because of his direct persecution of Jews. It's almost as if Claudius, the next emperor, AD 41 to AD 45, took the baton from Gaius, continuing the persecution. Now, it wasn't until the reign of Nero, good old insane freak Nero, I guess, AD 54 to AD 68, that all Roman eyes turned toward Christians. Specifically, it was after the fire in AD 64, in which Nero likely started a fire that destroyed much of Rome. This is when things turned hostile toward Christian, and I'm sure most of you know your history. They were made the scapegoat for the fire that he had likely ordered to be started because he wanted to refurbish things, rearrange things, redecorate, so to speak. Christians after this were arrested, if they admitted to being Christians, and were charged with hatred of mankind. This is an interesting quote here. The victims perished amid mockery Some clothed in the skins of wild beasts were torn to pieces by dogs. And after these cruelties, commiseration began to be felt for them, though guilty and deserving the sincerest penalties. For men felt their destruction was not from considerations of public welfare, but to gratify the cruelty of just one person, Nero. And that also was from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, Volume 4, page 216. Now, eventually, it was felt that Christians were undermining the religion of the state, and they earned the hatred of the populace, and a sect so detested must have fallen under surveillance of the city police administration. They were chosen by Nero as scapegoats to serve his purposes. The origin of the first persecution was thus purely accidental, in order to remove suspicion from the emperor. Nothing remains unchanged in life, though. You know, it's often ironic how we tend to repeat history. Eventually, persecution died, but it did take a while. In fact, it took several emperors before persecution of Christians began to wane. It wasn't until after the death of Domitian that peace prevailed for the Christians during the reign of Nerva and the first 13 years of Trajan. But this peace didn't prevail forever, as history tells us. Various emperors after Nerva either tolerated Christians or hated them. But God used this period to ultimately force Christians to flee throughout the Roman Empire, where the gospel could be preached as well, and the good news of Jesus Christ would be extended to the known world. But because of persecution, Christianity grew throughout the empire, changing lives for eternity wherever the gospel was preached. During the AD 192 to 284 period, Christianity's spread occurred virtually unmolested. The primary reason has to do with the fact that in the space of these 92 years, Rome experienced 20 emperors. No one ruler really stayed around long enough to focus on Christianity, and time had long passed since Nero's bid to blame Christians for the fire that had destroyed a good portion of Rome. And finally, in AD 313, through Constantine, who reigned from AD 311 to 476, came the first general edict of toleration regarding Christianity. And the edict was issued from the city of Milan, Italy. And this caused Christianity to be seen as equal to the paganism that reigned throughout the empire. Now, in truth, this persecution of Christians and the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jewish temple were the same very things that started the downhill slide for Rome. And this is interesting to note. At the same time, we've got to note that from Daniel 2, we learn that the two legs of the statue of the Roman Empire led directly to the feet. In fact, let's remember that everything is connected to what comes not only before, but afterwards, starting with the head. It is most likely why God used the image of a statue as he did in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The concept of the human body and how it functions is very, very important here. Now, if you have my book, Rome Rising, then you can turn to page 80, and or actually 78, and you can look at that and see how everything kind of ties together so nicely. You've got the whole statue in front of you. But let's look at something closely. The head made of gold sits atop the body, connected to the neck and shoulder area. But in the image, the head itself is made of gold, signifying superior value to everything that comes after it. And we've already discussed that. The chest and arms are made of silver. Two arms represent the fact that there are two cultures in that empire, the Medes and the Persians. The next empire down, which comes after the Medo-Persian Empire, is the Grecian Empire, led by Alexander the Great. His kingdom is made of brass, and that kingdom leads into the Great Roman Empire. The two legs represent the final stages of that empire when it was divided into a western and eastern branch. But we haven't got to the feet yet. The feet are considered to be a separate and final Gentile kingdom, but they are still connected to the previous Roman Empire. The kingdom is still part of the legs, just as our feet and legs connect. What this means is that the feet are of the same type as the legs, but they're also different. If we stop to consider and compare, we'll note that each successive kingdom, signified by a specific material, increases in value, but decreases in value. What I meant to say there was it increases in strength, but decreases in value. Again, this is simply summarizing what we've gone over. Gold is obviously more valuable than any of the other materials noted on the statue. At the same time, gold is not as strong as silver and certainly not as strong as iron. Iron is far stronger than gold, but the value is far less. God chose these images and symbols specifically. The Roman Empire was certainly the strongest of all the empires, yet it was the least valuable as far as worth is concerned. But its strength is what is keeping the Roman Empire alive today. Yes, it is alive today, but not as the Roman Empire. It's alive as something else entirely. It was in AD 290 that Emperor Diocletian decided to shift the center of the Roman Empire to the east. And this new state was known as the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Empire. Then the western half divided into five parts, split up among the Germanic tribes who continued to carry the mantle of Rome. The German rulers literally saw themselves as heir to the Roman throne. And if you look again in my book on page 80, or go to the internet, find a map of the current European Union, it basically encompasses much of what the old Roman Empire used to be. As of 2013, it's even gotten more countries since then. Now, as Rome continued, eventually Charlemagne became ruler and unified Western Europe, as well as recreated an equivalent of the old Roman Empire. Pope Leo III, in fact, had crowned Charlemagne legal heir to the previous Western emperors. That's important. Now, Charlemagne became the emperor of the Roman Empire, and this title eventually changed into Holy Roman Emperor until 1806. That's not that long ago, a few hundred years. The Western leg of the empire became known as the Holy Roman Empire. Now, again, if we look at Europe today, we see an entity known as the European Union, or the EU. There are 28 individual countries in the EU, but five of them, Spain, Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, were also part of the old Roman Empire. Obviously, they had different names then, but the geography remains the same. When the EU, the European Union, was in its infancy, only Belgium, Germany, France, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands cooperated with one another economically. And that was in 1951, 1952. The concept of the EU has been around for many years and has obviously grown quite a bit since then. The following countries are now part of the EU. There's 28 of them. I'm not going to read all of them together, but there are 28 of them that are now part of the EU. And you can again see that in my book, 81, 82 pages. You can go on the internet. That list of nations also highlights countries that have the largest voting blocks, and those are Germany, Italy, Spain, United Kingdom. They have the largest voting blocks. The small map I've included in the chapter shows where the EU is geographically in the world. As can be seen, many of the countries that are part of this union of countries were part of the old Roman Empire. And I think that that's very, very important. And we're going to continue our discussion on the EU and the old Roman Empire next time we meet. But until then, I pray that the Lord will open your eyes to show you how blessed you are.
You've been listening to Study, Grow, Know with Dr. Fred DeRuvo. Please join us each week for new broadcasts that deal with theology, prophecy, and political issues from a biblical, conservative perspective.